Welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with the movers, the shakers, the film and TV makers, the producers, the writers, the directors, the actors, the cinematographers, production designers, costume designers, sound editors, sound mixers, film editors, choreographers, composers, authors, you name it, and we talk to them. Very, very excited. It's October. Always a treat. One of my favorite months of the year, especially considering not only does it kick off the final quarter of the year, and after the year, all of the first three quarters, all of us have already had. Hopefully this one's going to be better. But October is Halloween month. It is the only holiday that somebody has not ruined for me. So I love Halloween. And boy, oh boy, some great films out this month on digital, on VOD, coming to theaters. We're all eagerly anticipating Halloween Ends, the final entry in the saga of Laurie Strode and Michael Myers. Can't wait to see that one. A lot of other good little film. Mr. Harrigan's Phone is coming out on Netflix. Mark your calendars, people. Written and directed by John Lee Hancock and is based on a Stephen King novella. And it's a goodie. I've already interviewed John about it. And you're going to hear that interview later this week on BehindTheLensOnline.net and maybe even next week right here on Adrenaline Radio on the show. I've been talking to a lot of filmmakers, horror filmmakers of late, and there's some great, great stuff. Last week I mentioned Greywood's Plot. Guys, that one is just so fabulous. Check it out. David Willing, another great horror filmmaker from Down Under. Surrogate is out. Another film that is coming out, I think this week, Frost, or it may have opened last week, starring none other than my friend Vernon Wells, the legend. That's a goodie. Just so much fun. And today, we're going to have some filmmakers on today talking about their entries into Halloween horror. We're going to have Raven Magwood join us shortly here, I hope, talking about her film, The Haunted Trail. And yes, it's exactly what you think it is. It is a Halloween haunt that incorporates haunted Halloween house rooms with haunts out on a trail in a forest. And one of the really cool things about this film, number one, it takes a lot to scare me. I watched this at home in the pitch dark. Yes, no lights. I watched the film in the dark. And there are so many moments where I was jumping off the couch. And so much of it, and I can't wait to talk to Raven about it, Mad World Haunted Attractions in Piedmont, South Carolina is where they shot this film. So obviously there's a lot built in here into the Haunted Trail that is courtesy of Mad World Haunted Attractions. And who knew that Piedmont had that? I've been to Piedmont, but that's a cool thing to boast about in your city. And at the midpoint of the show, Paul Schuyler is going to join us, talking about his film, Red River Road, which piggybacks on the whole idea of a pandemic. But this one, but in Red River Road, the pandemic is actually spread through the internet and robs a person of their ability to perceive reality. So it's like, is this live? Is this in my mind? Am I insane? You don't know what's real, what's not real, who may be infected, who isn't. And he shot this in May of 2020 as the whole world was going in their initial lockdown. and he utilized his entire family. You know, I'm a big proponent of family, cheap labor. And he used them. They all star in the film, including the family dog, Brody, who is my favorite character in the film. I will tell you that. But it's another one that just, you can't look away, and it leaves you wondering, are we imagining everything we've been living through? Well, we're going to talk to Paul about that a bit later. But right now, I'm so excited to welcome Raven Magwood to the show. Hello, Raven.
Hey, how are you?
I am very fine and very happy to be speaking with you about The Haunted Trail.
Yes, yes.
I love this film, Raven.
Thank you.
I love this film. It, as you know, at the top of the show, I was telling the audience, it takes a lot to scare me with a film. But this one, I sat in my living room, watched it in the dark. You and Robin Givens have given us more jump scares. I was literally jumping off the couch more than a few times watching this. This is what you want in a Halloween horror film. It's fantastic.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
And now you are wearing so many hats with this film because you're a co-writer, you're a co-director, and you're one of the main actors.
Yes.
Yeah. Let me start with the writing part. You wrote this with your writing partner, Paul Lindsay. Where did the idea for this film arise? You know, we're so used to haunted Halloween houses. But this, you take it outside in a forest, and I love the location. You shot this in South Carolina, in Piedmont. I've been to Piedmont. So the forestry there, it is thick. At night, you cannot see what you're doing or where you're going. Just in and of itself, if you're outside in the dark, it's scary. But you guys up the ante, and then you shoot this at Mad World Haunted Attractions. Had you been to Madwood before? Is that what gave you the idea? How did this all start for you on the page?
I actually had never been to Mad World before. I had taken a group of my girls to another haunted trail in South Carolina. And they were a group of girls that I coach gymnastics. And it was just a fun, scary time. And I remember getting home that night and telling myself, I want to write a screenplay about this. And so I ended up that night just kind of organizing some things and seeing how I could write a movie about a haunted trail. And then a few months later in 2020, of course, the world shut down with the pandemic. And so I had nothing but time. And I ended up just writing the first version of the screenplay then.
Oh, my God. Well, how much did this change since your first version to what we now see on the screen in terms of developing your characters, situations, things like that? Because you've got some really engaging, fun characters. You got some that are not so fun. and you never know what to expect. You and Robin together have unimaginable things jumping out of every corner from behind every tree. And it's just, how did you get to the point of what we see? Is it very similar to the first draft or?
Yes. So the first draft and what we actually see on screen is actually very similar. I did have to change a bit when we were deciding on which set to use. And when I contacted the owner of Mad World, he let us do a tour. And so I changed a little bit of the story to be able to accommodate what they already had and the sets that they were already utilizing for their haunted trails in the Halloween season. So there was a little bit of change there. And then when we signed our actors, of course, they brought their own personalities and things to the set, which really helped to bring their characters alive. So, yes, it then ended up becoming what we see now as Haunted Trail, the movie.
Well, one of the great things, because you were shooting this at Mad World, and they showed you what they had and what they could use, that had to help you from a directorial standpoint and from a production design standpoint, because it was already there, and AKA that saves money.
Yes, no, it was perfect from a producer standpoint, because that was my fourth hat. I produced the film as well. So to be able to utilize their sets, of course, that was amazing. We only had to change, you know, a limited amount of things. Mm-hmm. So it was there for us. And everything just looked amazing, because that's their forte, to scare people every Halloween. So we were able to utilize it and really make it what you see on the movie.
Wow. Well, I mean, and then that may be their forte, but then this is definitely a forte of yourself and Robin and your cinematographer, Rafa Bola.
Rafa did an amazing job to be able to capture what we wanted. And then Robin, with her direction, everyone worked really well together to bring.
I have to tell you, Rafa's work is just incredible. The cinematography is stunning. We get, you know, the mist and the night air, because a lot of people, mm-hmm. if they haven't been back east at night, especially in the forested areas, the air gets really heavy with humidity. Yes. Even if it's October, November, it's very, very heavy. And you can literally almost see it. And Rafa picks that up and then counters this with these incredible close-ups, some really great mid-close-ups within the rooms. And I'm still trying to figure, he had to have been shooting a lot handheld on this one, because those corridors and things are not wide at all.
Yes, we did a lot of handheld work, Steadicam work, and it just really captured what I envisioned. And so I'm very thankful for the crew as well.
Well, as far as your vision goes, I have to say first we get an opening that will scare the bejeebus out of everybody watching. Well, I'm not going to tell anybody what it is, but it will scare the bejeebus out of you. And then we get into the friends meeting, congregating, and talking about in their separate little groups, the guys and the girls, meeting up to go on this haunted trail. And the pizza shop or wherever their first meeting, I have to tell you, the fact that the camera just does a 360 around them at the table and another 360, that I thought was so telling and so key, because it puts us off guard immediately. Already we're unsettled as to what's going to be happening.
Yes, and that was something that we really wanted to portray on screen, myself, Robin, and Rafa. We talked about this even before shooting, that we wanted to utilize that 360 shot, and you'll see it a few times throughout the film.
Yes, and it works so well, because what it also does is it metaphorically, tacitly casts suspicion as to, is somebody behind this? You know, everybody, it's almost like we're pointing at everybody. You know, well, did you know? What did you do? Well, you're the one that wanted to come here. Did you know this was going to happen? Did you set this up? And you really, the blame game happens just through the camera movement. And I thought that was really interesting, Raven. It's not often I get to see something that's that thought out. And that's consistent throughout the film.
Thank you so much.
Did you guys shot list? Did you storyboard? How did you go about breaking this down?
Yes, we had a pretty distinct shot list and things that we knew we had to capture. We started off with a 12-day shoot. And then we ended up coming back for 3 more days for a reshoot. So we really did this in the span of a couple of weeks. So we knew we had to get in, know what we wanted to get and get out. So, yes, we were very detailed about the shots we needed to make the story not only make sense, but to look like how we wanted it to look.
You know, how difficult was the camera blocking since so much of this had to be handheld and Steadicam, just based on the logistics?
Yes, it wasn't too difficult in the sense we had a very experienced crew. Mm-hmm. Our camera crew was amazing. Rava directed them in an amazing way. And so they even brought ideas to the table where, you know, me and Robin might have said what we wanted to see, and they would just immediately say, okay, we can do it by doing this. You know, we can angle it here. We can coincide these two shots. And I mean, they were just amazing. Like, we could just really say what we wanted, and then they could pick it up and make it happen.
Well, and you mentioned camera angles, and so many of the angles that we get within the various haunted rooms are fabulous. Nothing is shot straight on, or almost nothing.
No.
Everything, it is skewed one way or another.
Right, and that was on purpose.
There's a few great dutching shots, because normally if you're dutching, it's for a power play. But here, mm-hmm. this is just horizontal tilts and mm-hmm. really, really disconcerting. And it really made me feel like I was standing in there and it was going topsy-turvy.
Yes, exactly. And so, you know, I appreciate the fact that you really caught on to what we were trying to do. Because, of course, in filmmaking, you don't want anything to be so jolted that the audience recognizes it. But to be able to appreciate the filmmaking process and understand what we were doing, and for you to see it, that makes us feel amazing.
You know, how strictly, because you've got so many personalities here in the cast, you don't have a big principal cast. It's a nice mm-hmm. it's a nice ensemble of basically five of you, and then Matt William Knowles is kind of a sixth wheel. But mm-hmm. and then you've got extra people, you know, popping up in various capacities. So basically it's five of you. So that's a nice size for an ensemble. How strictly did you need to stick to the script, or was everybody given room to improv? Because you have some really good comedians in this bunch.
Right, right, yes. So as a writer, of course, you know, everyone asks, you know, how much are you willing to have some wiggle room, or do we need to just say this word for word? And me and Robin talked about it, and I was very free. And yes, of course, the story needs to go in the direction that I wrote it, but I want you guys to feel comfortable and to be in your own personalities, because everyone has an amazing personality. Let's just get on set and have fun. You know, I was acting in the film too. So I was like, even my own words, I'm not going to necessarily stick to if a situation arises in which it would be cool to say something else or to exaggerate something. So we did give everyone freedom to take the words and bring their own personalities to it. And I think the ad libs are what really helped to make the film.
I mean, it's some of the dialogue and the personalities. Desi Banks as Zay, he is a scream.
Yes.
He is a scream. And, you know, through so much of this, he screams and cries like a little girl. You know, now, granted, most little girls today are much stronger. But I'm talking about the way we would think of screaming like a little girl back in the 30s and the 40s and, you know, he is hilarious. Hilarious.
Yes.
And we get to see so much of you with him.
Yes.
And you just don't have the right time of day for him anymore. Your character, Portia.
Yes.
Nope. Zay, you blew it. You blew it.
It was fun. It was fun to shoot with him and to really just kind of bring that storyline to light. It was a lot of fun, because this was my first acting role. So it was cool to be able to learn and to be on the other side of the camera, because I really prefer to be behind it.
Well, let's talk about you being in front of the camera. Obviously, while you're on screen, Robin is directing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how did you find those beats? How did you develop Portia since this is your first acting job, you know, in front of the camera. It's not easy.
So I knew, obviously, from writing what I wanted Portia to be, but Robin really came in as the director and just helped me find her more. And Robin would always say, you know, Raven, I want you to look good, and I want you to feel comfortable, and I want you to really bring Portia to light. And so with her encouragement and then having an amazing cast around me, I was just able to really have fun, and I think that's what the camera captured.
Well, I do have to tell you, as Portia and bestie Jackie, as the two of you are getting ready to go to the haunt, and Jackie is saying, change your shoes. And you're like, yes. No, they're thick heels. I can run in them. No, change your shoes. All I kept thinking of was Bryce Dallas Howard in the first Jurassic World, where the big thing was she's wearing high heel shoes, running through dinosaur country. And it just, it was such a moment of levity that you gave us after the initial opening, which takes a while for your heart to stop racing after seeing that. And now you give us some laughter. We've already met, you know, we're meeting the crew at the same time that are out having pizza or whatever. And before everybody gets in the cars and heads off. So that was a nice moment of levity about shoes.
And yes.
I thoroughly enjoyed that.
Thank you.
But, you know, how difficult physically was this? Because you are going through the rooms, but then you are also out on trails and in the woods. Did you have to watch where you were putting your feet? Were there, you know, do they keep it relatively clean so people aren't tripping over branches and whatnot?
Yes. Well, of course, we had our crew and, you know, our safety department that worked to make sure that everyone was safe and that our paths were clear. But of course, we're in the woods, so we did have to be careful and make sure that we were watching our steps. But the physical demand really just came from shooting through the night. We shot from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. Those were our shooting hours and days, so it just was a lot to do in that short period of time. But I think we were just having so much fun on set that it wasn't as bad until we finished, and we were just all so tired and exhausted. But while we were doing it, it was just so much fun. We didn't realize how much work we were really putting into the film.
But that's a sign of a good film. A happy crew, a happy cast makes for a good filmmaking experience. And that shows. That shows.
Yes. I really do believe that shows on film when people watch it. And so, you know, I'm just super excited that, you know, just a vision that I had after taking my gymnast to a haunted trail turned into haunted trail. It's just amazing.
How difficult was it casting this film? Because you do have so many different personalities. You know, you've got the five core, and then you throw in Matt's character of Mark as the main personalities here. But especially for, you know, Reggie Coos, who plays Austin, that had to be a very difficult role to cast.
At first, it was. We were thinking about a lot of different individuals for the role, but when I did a Zoom call with Reggie, he just blew it out the park, and I knew that he was Austin. So from that point, it was like, okay, we found Austin, and we were done casting, and everyone just really, even with our different personalities, got along on set really well, and it just made for that great chemistry that you see when you watch the film.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the, that is such a standout here, Raven, the chemistry amongst all of you. It really feels like you have all known each other. I mean, yes, we have one person who's quote-unquote new to the group and disappears quickly. That's all we're going to say. Disappears somewhere into the haunted rooms, disappears quickly, so that the core of you, we really focus on that. And you feel the camaraderie. You feel the joviality, the ribbing. You know, the, it's like, you know, Zay, get out of my face. I caught you with this, these other women. I want nothing to do with you. you know, I don't care if you're scared. Go hold on to somebody else. and this is the kind of stuff you can pull off and get away with your longtime friends. So there was not a minute I did not believe that this group of you had not been friends forever.
Yes.
You know, how difficult was the editing process on this one? Were you in there with Michael Tang and Robin? Because finding the pace on a film like this is always a challenge. Because you need to build.
Yes.
And you want to scare the bejeebus out of us, but then you got to build again.
Right. So we were actually never in the same room with COVID. We tried to do post, you know, as safe as possible, but with the workflow that we had, we were able to upload and watch, you know, as he was developing the edit. And so he would send us what he had based on our notes, and we would go over it. We would write our notes and kind of go back and forth. And I think he was able to really capture the vision as well. So I can't use the word difficult to describe the process. It was fun, and we enjoy putting all of our heads together to make it what it is.
This sounds like it, that it truly is one of the most collaborative film sets that I have had the pleasure to talk with any director and filmmaker about.
Most definitely.
You know, how important was that when you and Robin went into this? You know, how important was it to the two of you that you had this kind of open collaboration with everybody?
I think it was very important because, you know, we both like to work with individuals that are going to help make the story the best it can be. And the only way that's going to happen is if you do have that positivity among the cast and crew. And so we were able to establish that very early, and everyone that was hired or became a part of the set knew the vision that we had and the environment that we wanted to build both on and off set. And so, everybody was on board, and we were able to make something amazing.
How did you and Robin divvy up your directorial duties? Since you're on
so
screen part of the time.
Yes. So she actually came in as the sole director originally. Mm-hmm. And so as a producer, I hired her to direct. And I originally had no intention of directing or co-directing. But when we didn't finish exactly what we needed to in those 12 days and we had to come back, she was not able to come back for the reshoot. And so she gave me her blessing to direct the reshoot. And so that reshoot included a lot of critical scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up directing those as the sole director then. And so that's how the credits worked as far as directed by Robin Givens and co-directed by me.
Mm-hmm. Makes perfect sense. Makes absolute sense. And especially since during the principal photography, you're on camera.
Right, exactly, for most of the time.
I know, you know, Greg Kinnear, when he directed himself in a feature film, and he's in like 95% of the film, and he told me, he goes, I am never going to do that again.
Mm-hmm.
He said,
it's a lot.
It's too difficult. To direct yourself for that much of a film.
Right. Right.
You know, now that this whole thing is said and done and you look back at it, do you have a favorite scene? Do you have a favorite moment? And am I going to get a sequel to this?
So to answer the question about the sequel, I am working on some treatments and kind of seeing where we can take the story, because I've gotten that request a lot. I get messages all the time. When is the sequel coming out? Are you writing one? And so we're just going to start from there. We do have distributors interested. So the demand is definitely there for a sequel. I can't give a timeline on it, but certainly working towards that. And just looking back on the film, I don't know if I have a favorite scene, but I do. I did just enjoy being with the cast, like even after the first death happened, and we see that 360 shot of us outside.
Mm-hmm.
Of I really enjoyed that scene. It was a lot of fun to shoot because of the 360 shot. When you are on camera, we have a lot of behind the scenes of the people that aren't on camera doing silly things, and so the person that's on camera is trying not to laugh while acting scared. So it was just a fun scene to shoot. So because of the behind-the-scenes aspect, that's probably my favorite scene that we did.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I can't wait to see what you do next, Raven. Are you working on other project other than possible treatments for a sequel?
Yes, I do have a new project that I'm working on. We're in pre-production. I can't speak too much about it, but it will be a sports film. It'll be a drama, not a horror. But the script has been received extremely well, and we have quite the cast signed up to do this film. So I'll be excited to come back and speak with you about it. I'm super excited to start shooting soon.
Well, and I'll be super excited to have you come back and speak with me about it, let me tell you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Raven, this has been such a joy. This is a perfect film for this month.
Thank you.
Horror film is good for any day of the year, as far as I'm concerned. But especially this month, and everybody can see it, and they should. It's The Haunted Trail. It is fabulous, Raven. Fabulous.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And you have a great rest of the week. And hopefully we will chat sooner rather than later.
Okay, you too. And thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Raven. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
And that was Raven Magwood. We're talking about The Haunted Trail. And now we're going from haunted trails to haunted internets and pandemics. Paul Schuyler, are you there?
I am here.
Hi, Paul. Is it just you, or is it?
It's just me. Yeah.
Oh well, you know, I'll make do. welcome.
Jake gets a little shy. Oddly,
you'd never know it watching her in Red River Road.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of a strange. It's perplexing.
Well, something else that is perplexing is, and I have to say that for a film that was shot in May of 2020, right after, as the whole world was going into lockdown, this is one of the best pandemic storylines, a very unique spin on a pandemic in this film, but also so well done, utilizing the free labor within the family, and none of this zoom cut that a lot of filmmakers were doing to create films during the pandemic. This is a straightforward narrative film structure with cameras actually there.
Yeah.
And no zoom for outlines. It made me very happy. I will tell you that.
Thank you.
But you take the idea of a pandemic and lockdown to new levels with Red River Road. Talk to me about, describe for the audience, describe for the listeners, the idea of your particular pandemic that you have created here and what it does.
So the idea in Red River Road is that the pandemic spreads through the internet electronically, and it slowly erodes your ability to perceive reality. So much so that you don't even realize it's happening. So the question becomes throughout the movie, what is this real? Is what I'm experiencing real, both for the characters and for the audience?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of like being on the internet every day of the week anyway.
Yeah.
Erodes the mind, skews reality, you know. So, and
I should say preemptively that, I'm sorry, there's some interference on the line. It's a little distracting. I apologize. Originally, it was just, I just didn't want to go straight head on with COVID.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that it spread electronically was just a means to really cut off the characters from the outside world. That was my intention. As we started screening it at film festivals and getting feedback, the idea that, oh, yeah, this really obvious thing about being exposed to social media and echo chambers and how it really does distort a person's, you know, grasp of, well, it makes your reality so personal and might not have something, you know, might not be in line with somebody else's reality. So that wasn't intentional, just kind of a happy accident that was probably just percolating in the back of my mind at the time, and that's came out. But it's not meant to be a political movie. It's not meant to make a statement about that, even though it does.
For me, it just reminds me of how, the inability to perceive reality and what's real and what's not real. And that has reached a crescendo thanks to social media the past few years. People don't know what's real, what's not real, what is fake news, what. Even through advertising, a lot of platforms that are out there now. So this really, this fits the world so well today. And I'm sure that you really weren't plotting that out. You just slipped
out. I wasn't.
You know, now once you get this script written, how long did it take you to develop this, to write this? Because obviously you've got a minimal cast. You just have the family and Brody the dog, and I love Brody the dog. My
he
favorite.
Steals the movie for sure.
No offense to anyone, but Brody is my favorite character.
None taken. She had two scenes in the original script. I think she's in half the movie. But she just was so good. We were just like, oh, let's add this or let's add this part. Let's see if she can do this. She was just fantastic.
Well, Brody adds so much because Brody raises the stakes. When Brody sits in the living room and is, you know, upright and ears perked up and staring out the front window or the door and starts this growling, it's like, okay, there's not people around. What is Brody growling at? What is there some unknown malevolent, you know, force out there, you know, what's going on? So Brody really,
yeah,
she heightens
the
stakes.
The coal mine.
Oh yeah. Brody's great. But as you're writing this out, were you writing it thinking of each of your family members and bringing in their own traits or personalities into this? Or were you really trying to distinguish between these characters and your boys, Sean, Quinn, how is that working for you?
So I'll be honest, the script came about really quickly. I was supposed to shoot another movie called Tuna Goddess, which Jade wrote a play of, and we did an adaptation for the screen. We had financing, we had a cast. When COVID hit, that ended that. And then we got locked down, and I was like, this is kind of the worst nightmare scenario of getting so close to achieving a dream, and then it's gone. So out of that, I just had the idea, like, let's just shoot something in the house. We're going to be stuck here for at least 2 weeks. Let's shoot something here. We're all actors. I have all the equipment. And I went to bed that night with that just idea in my head, and I literally woke up in the middle of a dream that's basically the movie you see. So I just grabbed a piece of paper and just started writing down notes. And I think within 10 days, the script was done.
Wow.
So it came fast. So I didn't really, part of it is, my intention was that these are characters.
Mm.
You know, it's not just us. It's not a meta version of us.
Right.
But naturally, just because they're my family, traits or things I know they're going to be good at expressing or projecting on screen just kind of came through in the writing. But the highest order was that these are created characters. This is a created family. So yeah, they're close to us, but I'm not Steven. And even though there are traits, I think that goes for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did you go about planning from a shooting standpoint, how you were going to shoot this? Because, you know, you're in the confines. Yes, it's your house. You know the layout of the house, but then you've also got to navigate. You need to get camera angles. You need lighting. How did you go about approaching this from the actual production standpoint?
Well, the first thing I did was I shot with the Blackmagic pocket cinema camera because I knew I needed something really small and something that can be moved around quickly. So it was really about just scaling things back. And, you know, I'm a big fan of John Carpenter, and he's always good at really laying out the geography, especially in The Thing. You know exactly where everybody is at one time. So I wanted to have that. Also in Alien, the way Ridley Scott sort of gives you an introduction and education of the ship, so that when things start going wrong, you can, you know where everybody's in relation to each other. So I've kind of mapped out in the script that I wanted you to get a sense of the layout of the house, knowing that I was building up to the ending where it would be important that you knew where everything is and how everything sort of connects. So that was, and then it was just a matter of breaking down the scenes and going, all right, we're going to shoot everything that's in the living room today. So all our mess is going to go in the kitchen. And then, you know, 2 days from now, we're going to shoot all the kitchen stuff. So all that's got to move back into the living room. So there's a photo somewhere. I have to dig it up of what our house looked like behind the camera. And it was a nightmare. It was so much of our personal stuff because we wanted it to look sparse. We didn't want it to look like it's supposed to be their summer house.
Yeah. Well, in a summer house, you don't have that much stuff in. You know, it's
right.
You only show up in the summer and then you load up the car with what you're going to need and that's it. But yeah, no, I do have to tell you, I love your kitchen. Your kitchen's great. I love your kitchen.
Thank you. Needs a new stove.
You know, how involved did Jade and Shaw and Quinn get, especially when you're on camera? Were the boys doing camera operation? You know, what'd you do for lighting? Things along those lines.
So it was basic lighting. I tend to shoot, if there's natural light that's working, go with that. I find there's a lot of magic there. So I kept the lighting scaled back. Except, of course, the night stuff, you know, trying to get that subtle look like it's nighttime, but you can still see things.
Yeah.
So they didn't do much in terms of setting up lights or equipment, but there was definitely, everyone had camera duty. In fact, there's two shots in the film where we're all in the shot and the camera's moving. And we had to rig up this whole rope and pulley system.
Oh my God.
That we could manipulate the camera while the scene was going on.
Oh my God.
Because I didn't think anybody like in the moment watching it would go, hey, how are they all in that shot? But subconsciously, it would give a sense of like, oh, there's a crew here. Like, this is, they're making, you know, a movie's being made and these are just the actors.
Wow. Well, you know, another big part of this piggybacks on what I said earlier about Brody with the ears perking up and growling. And that's when you take us outside of the house into the yard. Or outside when Jade is when the character of Anna, she's picking up the military green box that's left at the foot of the driveway every day.
Every day. Yeah.
Which is like, that's creepy in and of itself. That's creepy in and of itself. But then you bring in, and this is where your score, it's a very minimal score, but this is where your score and your sound really comes into play and marries with your script. As we go into the yard or hit the end of the driveway and you can't go any further.
Right.
That added a whole new element to this whole tale. I got to tell you, Paul.
Thank you.
I did not.
That was my intention, so yay.
I did not expect that. especially with the yard, because the yard opens up into, you know, woods, which is what you find back east a lot, especially with summer homes. And, you know, you think that somebody can just go wandering. The dog can wander. Anybody can go out and wander. You know, go play baseball. Go throw a football in the yard. And, yeah, so it went 50 feet into the forest. We'll go get it. But you can't.
Nope.
And the fact that it didn't just happen once, it happened more than that. And you've got great music cues in there. Great motif. And you composed the music as well, yes?
I did. I co-composed it with Cindy O'Connor, who's a Grammy-nominated composer, who's a good friend, and was so inspired by what I was trying to do. She offered to help, which was a godsend, because really splitting the load with her, we were able to elevate it. She brought in some really emotional elements to the score that I think takes us outside of a horror movie in ways that are unexpected, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. Well, this definitely goes beyond a horror movie because it really makes us think as we're watching, you know, is everything imagined? Whose mind is this happening in? Is this reality? Is there governmental mind control involved that circles back on itself and basically resets every day? You open up all these possibilities. And at the same time, you really, through Jade's character of Anna, you really feel a sense of loss, a sense of confusion, a sense of self-questioning. Whereas we get to see you just blow up into a rage in one key scene, which probably every parent in the world can relate to. When you want,
especially about them being on their phones too much.
That's it. That's it. That's the touchstone. That came from real life. I'm betting that came from real life.
I have some sense memory to draw from.
Yes. But you really, and the score that you have, as I said, it's minimal, but it's also very minimalist. And it really just comes in like an undercurrent. You've got a beautiful montage segment in there with Anna. That, and I'm sure you know, because it's the only real montage you have, an exploratory one. That is really, it's interesting. It's also chilling when you watch it. But then you also give us these great flashbacks. Did you use old home movies for the flashbacks?
I did.
So cute. So cute.
Yeah, we were. I was lucky to have this treasure trove of footage of the kids, especially when they're young. And I had somebody tell me at one of the film festivals that it wasn't until the second dream sequence that they realized that that was us. They were like, "How did they get actors that look so much like them, like little kid actors that look so much like the boys?"
Oh my god!
That's a fun surprise.
Well, what I loved is because of the fact that the ocean is there and their beach scenes, which coincides with the summer house near the ocean on the beach, empty lifeguard tower, little kids splashing in the waves. So I figured it had to be home movies that you had stashed in the house.
Yeah.
And since you were in your summer house, obviously they were in the attic somewhere.
Right. Well, this is actually our house. I wish I had a summer house. No, this is our actual house.
But what you also did, what did you do to your archival footage, to those home movies? Because they've got a different patina, and in some instances, it looks like somehow they're brightened up, lightened up, almost with sun flares, that was in there originally.
I mean, some of it was just the nature of what they were shot on. Some were high 8, some were some old iPhone footage. But a lot of it just had to do with, I have a friend of mine, Jeff Bassett, who's a great cinematographer and excellent color timer, grader. Mm-hmm. It was his magic. I gave him an idea of what I was after, and he just stirred the pot, and that's what came out.
Well, it works really well because it really heightens that idea of what is reality? Is this reality? Is this a fading memory? Is this just a memory burst? And whose is it?
Right.
You keep the questions coming, Paul. I don't know how you kept all these balls in the air, but you do it on a thematic level. And it's just so well played out.
Thank you. I have, to be honest, I think it's because I just got out of my own way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I just really let the story come through. And unless it was like, well, I got to kind of get him in this direction, I didn't really manipulate the plot. I just followed where the story and the characters went. And personally, I like movies that ask a lot of questions.
Mm-hmm.
So long as I have a sense that the director has a frame of reference that they're using and it's not just to be clever or confusing for confusion's sake,
mm-hmm.
I'll go on that ride. And so that's what I tried to build with this is I have a clear idea of what I'm saying. You may have a completely different story, and that's fine because the movie's built that way,
mm-hmm.
that you can have your own interpretation of it. But I did have a clear understanding of what I was trying to say.
Mm-hmm. You know, how did you go about your editing process here? Were you editing as you went? Because obviously, okay, you're in your own house. If you need pickup shots, if you need a reshoot, it's easy to do. If you find something's missing, did you just shoot everything first and then sit down to edit? What was that process like for you? And at what point did you then start thinking about scoring to come in, since that is such an integral part of this story?
So the plan was we were going to shoot for 10 days and get the bulk of the movie done.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was going to cut for a couple of months. And then we were going to do a week of reshoots,
mm-hmm.
Which was great because it allowed me to sort of see what I had made and then rewrite a little bit, add some scenes, go back and reshoot things that, like, that didn't quite land. I mean, at the time we shot it, it felt like it was true to the script, but now that we're sort of rewriting it and editing, this needs to be stronger, this needs to be softer. And then I think once the cut was done, we went back and shot maybe a day, day and a half, just pickups to kind of stitch things together that needed a little help.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a really enjoyable way to make a movie. I don't know if studio gave me money if they would be up for something like that. But I think it allows a filmmaker to really explore what they're creating, as opposed to just cha-ching stamping out product.
Mm-hmm. You know, one interesting thing in the film is the fact that the phone, it's the old analog, old handset, dial the digits with your finger, let your fingers do the walking. Do you actually have that phone in the house, or did you have to bring that in? Did you have it packed away somewhere?
No, we do a lot of theater work here, and we have worked really closely with the Cape Rep Theater in Brewster near us, and they have a huge prop room. So we just put a call into them, like, do you have a old rotary phone? And I'm like, we have 20. Come pick one out.
Well, I hate to admit it, but in our family house back in suburban Philadelphia, the original rotary phone is still on the wall, and my dad had rigged it up with the push button attached to it, but it's still on the wall. And yes, if you want to, you can still dial, put your finger in each little hole and dial the number if you want. But they're few and far between anymore. So that tickled me to see that was brought into this film. And obviously it works perfectly because of the very nature of how this pandemic is transmitted. You know, people don't think about it. Wouldn't be transmitted through a copper hardwire rotary phone.
But that was sort of the idea behind that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I really appreciated that little touch that you
and also the fact that they get movies delivered on Blu-ray. They can't stream anything.
Yeah.
That has to be physical media.
Well, now that begs the question. Are all of those your DVDs and Blu-rays?
Yes.
Nice. I like the shelving.
Yeah. We had a movie-themed restaurant for years here on Cape Cod, and when all the Blockbusters started shutting down, we bought all their stock and opened up a video store attached to our restaurant and did that for a couple of years. So I think we had about 9,000 movies.
Wow.
And when we sold the restaurant, I sold off a little over half the stock, and the rest live in my basement now. So,
well,
I have my own little video store.
Okay. Well, boy, I was loving that. I thought that looked great. Did you run into any licensing issues with, because we do get to see, watch a few little scenes from various films that have been delivered to the family to watch in their mysterious, you know, courtesy of the mysterious green boxes. Did you have any licensing issues with getting clearance for those clips that you were using?
We did. The original incarnation, I think, at one point we're watching Jaws.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, you know, let's see how much it costs to get the license for Jaws. And Universal was like, we don't give the license out. You have to get permission from Steven himself. And unless you're Chris Nolan, we're not even going to ask him. So, sorry. Which I understand. So, fine. So, what is in the movie now was what we could, kind of a balance of stuff I wanted to show that seemed like something they would be watching, as well as a nod to my heroes,
mm-hmm.
And then what we could afford. The best one, if I can just tell a quick story.
Please
so
do.
So we used a scene from The Ninth Configuration, which is written and directed by William Blatty,
mm-hmm.
who the writer of The Exorcist. And it's one of my favorite films. It's a pretty obscure film. I encourage anyone to get their hands on it to watch it. It's brilliant. And I reached out to Warner Brothers. They were the last distributor that had it. And they said, oh, all the rights are reverted back to William. He owns all the rights. Well, he passed away a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I happened to find his widow, Julie, on Facebook, messaged her. And she was like, William would be so honored to be in your movie.
Aww.
And go ahead, use whatever you want. And I just felt like just having, you know, he's one of my heroes, obviously, to have that personal connection and that gift from his family just meant the world. So we added a dedication at the end of the
mm-hmm.
of the movie to him, fittingly. So.
Oh, that's so sweet. That is really, that's lovely.
She was great.
But, yeah, I know what a big fan you are of Jaws, considering that your sons are named Sean Quinn and your dog is Brody.
And the dog that passed away, who you see two shots of, was named Hooper.
Hooper, yeah. So, yeah, it's a shame.
It's an obsession.
I can tell. So it is disappointing that you didn't get to use any Jaws clips or posters or anything like that. But the film is none the worse for wear.
We end up using The Thing, which I think thematically works better because it has to do with isolation and distrust. So in the end, it was Jaws would have been a distracting thing,
mm-hmm.
I think, and having The Thing in there is more in line with the movie. So it's totally fine.
And now tomorrow, everybody can see Red River Road because
launching streaming
tomorrow. On all all the digital platforms, all the usual suspects.
Yes. And there's a flash sale going on right now on iTunes for pre-order, which it's going to last until tomorrow. So if anybody wants to get a jump start on it and save a couple bucks, you can find it on iTunes.
Otherwise, all the digi platforms are going to have it. And it's, you know, it's an intriguing, it's a riveting watch. You cannot look away, and it's 90 minutes long, 91 minutes long. It moves along quickly. There's a lot packed in there from perhaps a philosophical thematic standpoint, but it moves quickly, and you don't realize it's over by the time it's over.
Yeah, we definitely wanted it to gather steam. as it went.
And it does that. And there's so much I would like to say about certain things, but I can't because it will be very, very spoilery.
We don't want to spoil it.
No.
Yeah.
No. I'm sure you can tell I'm trying to dance around a couple things in the film that are so key.
I think you've done really well, actually.
Thank you.
I think we've done a deep dive without giving really anything away.
Yes. Because this is one of those films. It's not like a typical horror film where, okay, you can expect this, you can expect that. We're not going to say who it is or what happens. But with this one, it really, because you keep us on tenterhooks for a good portion of this film, Paul, wondering, as we start asking questions and learn more about what this pandemic is, and then when you find out that, okay, it's spread through the internet, and, you don't know if, what, that's like the question that, they ask you in high school, in a lot of courses, philosophy courses, and in college. Well, is this reality? Am I alive? Am I dead? Is everybody dead? You play on that, and it's something that all of us at one point or another had that posited to us through in education. In schools.
Right. Right.
And you take it to the next level here. And that always intrigues me. Those questioning things intrigue me.
There's another aspect to this that as we're talking, it occurs to me there's, on the surface, there's that one philosophical question. But there's also not really an answer, but this idea of connecting to the people. Because there's a scene early on where Steven's comforting Anna,
mm-hmm.
and he's like, this is real. Like, this is how you can tell this is real. So I think that aspect is there too, the importance of real human connection.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you're sitting face to face with somebody, there's a certain truth that occurs. And I think that's why it's not social media's fault that this has happened. I think it's just a byproduct of being disconnected, thinking we're connected.
Right.
But nothing takes the place of sitting face to face with somebody or having a conversation with somebody.
That's exactly right. And being on Zoom does not count.
It's a nice. Thank God we had it, but we didn't all lose our minds. Completely lose our minds because we did kind of lose our minds. But yeah, it's a good reminder that to sit face to face with somebody.
Well, I will tell you, I have not used Zoom. In 2020, I did over 400 interviews, every one of them on the phone, all through COVID. All of my interviews have all been over the phone, over my hardwire copper landline. Yeah.
Well, I love it.
And no Zoom, no internet fallouts, dropouts, no. Because I still think a phone has you have more of a connection with somebody even than you do on Zoom. Because Zoom, so many people, they're worried about how they look. Is my hair okay? Is my makeup okay? Oh, do I have the best light? Oh, I didn't get the pink ring light because that makes all skin tone look good. oh, God, did I clean the house? It's in the background. No.
Right.
On the phone.
Running around for half an hour, like trying to checking all the angles before you get on Zoom to make sure you set a good stage.
Yeah, I did an interview with Jerry Butler, and he goes, I can't see you. I said, no. I said, I don't use Zoom. I dial in. He goes, cool. So I can pull my shirt out of my pants. I said, you can put your feet up on the table. You can do whatever you want. He goes, great. That's what I'm going to do right now. And I was told he did because, could let the guard, his guard down. And I've heard this from so many other people. It's like, oh, I'm so glad that we're only on the phone. I didn't want to take a shower this morning. I wanted to sit here in bed with my dog. And people get happy. It's more of a human connection. And that's
I totally agree.
And that's something that you really, that idea of connection. And then what happens when you have a connection after not having one? Or not knowing you have one. Just job so well done, Paul. So well done.
I really appreciate that.
I can't wait to see what you do next. Do you have any more features in the works?
We have. Well, there's Tuna Goddesses still sort of on the back burner.
Right.
We'll wait and see how that goes. And then I have a low budget dramatic thriller called Wasted that I'm working on right now, and putting the budget together and seeing what I need to raise. And yeah, but I think that's the next one that we're going to go for.
Well, I can't wait. I'm there for whatever you turn out next. I want to see your trajectory here. I want to see where you go after this one.
You and me both.
Oh, Paul, thank you so much. I hope you'll come back on the show again in the future.
Anytime. It's been a real pleasure.
And everybody, tomorrow, Red River Road, everyone can see it. And it's a perfect movie for this month, because it is kind of scary. It is scary. When you think about it, it is scary. And watching it, it's perfect for Halloween month. Paul, thank you.
Yeah, it's getting darker earlier. Yes. Perfect. Thank you.
I watched it pitch dark. First, I watched The Haunted Trail in the dark, jumped out of my skin a few times, and then I watched yours right after it. And still was ready to jump out of my skin a few times. So
Nice.
Paul, thank you so much. You have a wonderful rest of your day, and hopefully we'll talk again soon.
Definitely, for sure.
Oh, thanks so much, Paul. Bye-bye.
Okay, take care. Bye.
And that was Paul Schuyler, writer, director, editor, cinematographer, producer, and composer. This is how you make a film in total lockdown. And you use the free labor of your family as talent and as production assistants. So, we have kicked off Halloween month with two perfect films. The Haunted Trail, available now. See it. Tomorrow, Red River Road, all digital platforms. Next week, Mai Hong is going to be joining us to talk about her documentary, Cat Daddies, which is just beyond adorable. I love Cat Daddies. Plus, we're going to hear one of my interviews about another horror film that's out this month. So, until then, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.